In our last story of the show, Melissa Levitt tells her story of going door to door in the swing state of Nevada to try and get voters to cast their ballots for John Kerry in the 2004 presidential election. Along the way, she learns a little about how we get people to vote and about the shady side of Reno hotels. Trapped her for years, it filled her heart up with fear. Made her feel like no one was near. When she needed a friend to call on in the end, and she's falling again. Now she's gone with the wind, and it's all because of him, and it's all because of her. So, you know, we're just driving down this, you know, strip, in quotations, as it were. You know, we turn in the hotel, we park in the parking lot, and basically, like, you know, finding the hotel was just the first part of the challenge. Now we actually had to figure out how to get to the front door of it because it was so run down. Like, the parking lot was just completely dark. I was actually kind of afraid walking from the car to the hotel that some, you know, kind of attacker was going to pop out of nowhere and whisk me away to some unimaginable fate. I'm sort of like tripping over speed bumps. I don't know where I am. My boyfriend is completely preoccupied looking for his cell phone so we can call our contact in the group. We're all trying to sort of like find the front doors. But we finally make our way to the front of the hotel. We go in the lobby and we know we're in the right place because there are basically two very different kinds of people in the lobby. And they're at opposite ends of the lobby, too. So it's like, okay, kind of, you know, choose your side right here. So we found the group that we were supposed to be with, you know, our fellow Blue State folks who were very, very clearly San Francisco hipsters. Like, they're all wearing their, you know, dark wash skinny jeans. They're like retro footwear, you know, Vans or Chuck Taylors or whatever. And T-shirts, you know, with these really pithy slogans that were silk screened on like about three decades ago. Sure you can imagine, you know. So this is one group. The other group on the other side of the lobby are, I guess, what you would call Reno natives. I'm assuming they weren't tourists because I don't think the hotel was a tourist destination. I couldn't actually see this other group, so I can't actually really describe them very well, but I knew they were there because the hotel actually had a kind of lounge act performing on the other side of the lobby, and I assume, you know, that's who the audience was.
Was it a good lounge act?
No, it was actually, you know, I assume that being the entertainment at this particular Reno hotel is sort of like an entry-level job in the larger Reno entertainment industry. I mean, it was terrible. You know, it was basically one guy singing, and he had a keyboard. So he could sing and he could play the keyboard, but apparently he couldn't do both at the same time. He was just, you know, his one kind of like trick seemed to be this awful, awful rendition of You Can Do Magic. And so, you know, he would kind of warble out the chorus from that song, like, You Can Do Magic, you know, followed by those three chords. And like, that was about all he could imagine, like, do, do, do. There was another person. I don't know if she was the audience, like the one audience member, or just part of the act, this woman sort of swaying to the beat, such as it was. She was sort of out in front dancing, and she kind of reminded me of the way that Muppets dance. I don't know if anyone else remembers this, but, you know, they had the strings, right, holding their arms. So it was kind of like leading with the elbows, like this very jerky kind of dancing.
So you didn't hit up the Reno nightlife?
No, I did not. I sort of felt like I saw enough of it trying to get there. And, you know, I'd been to Circus many times as a child. They have sort of the adult casino as well as like the kids casino with the skee ball and Whack the Groundhog. And like, that was actually more tempting. Maybe a little skee ball, but no.
You'd seen enough magic in the lounge.
Exactly. Exactly. I wasn't quite convinced I could do magic or anyone else could do magic, but yeah, I was ready to call it a night.
So how early did you have to wake up for the training?
So we had to get up. We had to be at this park where the training would take place around 8 in the morning, I think.
Did you at least get a good night's sleep beforehand?
No, and unfortunately, I didn't. It, you know, it was one of those nights where, you know, you toss and turn and you look at the clock and you hope that it says like 1 or 2, because then at least you could get a few hours, but it says 5 or 6.
You're doing the math in your head as it happens.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, by the time it's 6 o'clock, it's like, you just know it's all over. And at the time I was thinking, gosh, maybe I'm just like so excited to go register voters. But I actually learned a few weeks later when these horrible red bites appeared all over my legs that I was probably being kept awake by the bed bugs that were attacking me. It's a very, I hope that you've never been bitten by bed bugs, but it's a very distinctive kind of bite. So, you know, a little like Google imaging, and I knew exactly like what I was beset by.
So that's probably why I didn't get a great night's sleep before all of this.
Did the training fully prepare you for the ordeal ahead?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely tried to. They gave us a script that we could use to prepare us to talk to the Reno locals. And it was kind of, you know, it was some basic sort of issues about Bush and Kerry, but also sort of tailored to specific things that people in Nevada were concerned about at the time. So, for example, they had us talking about the Yucca, and as I'm saying this, I can't remember where it was, Yucca or Yucca Mountain, and I know this was important to our training. But anyway, the proposal
Yucca
at
Mountain,
the time... Yucca Mountain, yeah, okay. The proposal that was in the news at the time to bury nuclear waste under the mountain, which Kerry was opposed to, and we thought, you know, obviously this is something that people in the area are opposed to. So it was something that we were going to bring up. So the script had a guide to a bunch of these issues, and it also had a pronunciation guide for how to say Nevada. It's not Nevada, as Kerry had said, you know, just before the time I was taking this trip. You know, it's actually Nevada with, you know, that short A, like as flat an intonation as possible. And being a local, being a California girl, like I knew how to say this. But I have to say that it was one of those things that I was sort of feeling like, okay, I have to remember how to say Nevada properly. I just think that in these kind of weird, like sleep-deprived circumstances, everything was just feeling very foreign, like very unfamiliar, things that should be easy. I couldn't figure out anything, you know, that was going on. You know, we had this script and we were assigned a partner. And this was actually the person that we would be heading out into the field with. So I was assigned this guy, Matt, who was a firefighter from Santa Cruz. And he'd done this a bunch of times. And he was a great person to be doing this with because I was, you know, I was really kind of nervous. And he was kind of helping me through that. But it was something about the script just felt so stilted. It was, you know, we had this, like, opening we were supposed to do, and it just felt so ridiculous. Like, hi, my name is Melissa. I'm here to talk to you about blah, blah, blah. You know, this kind of robotic thing. And I was just so worried about how to even say hello to these people, which is really kind of, like, pretty rudimentary human interaction. But for some reason, you know, it just seemed like one of these things that was just going to be so difficult. I was kind of freaking out about it.
Did you run through different ways to say hi in your head beforehand?
Oh, yeah, of course. Like, should I be really chipper? You know, should I be just more kind of like down to earth? You know, I don't even, like, I can think of all these adverbs. I don't even know how, you know, the one syllable of hi would sound, like, in all of these different moods or tones. But yeah.
So what kind of people did you meet?
The other people at the...
Well, once you actually got out
okay.
on the street.
So once I actually got out into the field, I met some interesting people. Unfortunately, I only met like a small fraction of the people I thought I'd meet just because so many people just kind of didn't answer their doors. Like Matt and I were sent out to this pretty quiet suburb. I mean, I guess you can call it a suburb. Reno's not really a metropolis, but anyway, a smaller town than Reno. And it was just kind of eerily quiet. And I don't know if that's because people weren't home. I assumed it was just because they didn't want to answer their door to me, which actually made sense because I never answer my own door. The type of person we were supposed to meet was supposed to be pretty receptive to what we had to say. Like maybe they had never voted or they hadn't voted in a really long time. But if they had ever indicated that they leaned conservative, we were supposed to like not waste our time trying to convert them.
So there was a screening process
right.
beforehand.
So there's a screening process beforehand that Driving Votes or maybe one of the related organizations had done. So we basically were just handed a spreadsheet with names and addresses. And I think if they had ever registered in a party before, we saw what that was. So the first guy that I actually got to talk to, when he opened the door, I just had to sort of go on faith that he was one of these pre-screened people. He was, you know, I'd say 40s, maybe mid to late 40s. So this military style haircut. I mean, his hairline was receding, but what was left of it was in this military haircut, wearing like really faded jean shorts, like down to the knee, and one of those really baggy tank tops with the like enormous armpit holes that go down to your waist. And he just, you know, he opened the door and he didn't really say anything, but his head just kind of jutted out. And, you know, I was trying to be optimistic. I thought, oh, maybe he just wants to hear what I have to say better. But, you know, I think that it was probably just because he was just getting ready, like, to pounce, depending on what I had to say. So I gave him my little spiel, and I tried to start with the Yucca Mountain thing. I mean, he would have none of it. Like, as soon as I tried to compare Bush at all unfavorably to Kerry, like, he just looked absolutely repulsed. So clearly this was the moment in which I should have just kind of walked away, you know, just headed over to the next door. But I was still kind of green and still kind of optimistic, I guess. So I, you know, remembering my script, I kind of, you know, went on to the next issue, which was stem cell research. And I tried to present it in focusing on the good that it could do, you know, curing diseases, helping people. And this just absolutely, like, was anathema to him. He was absolutely not interested in saying this. And he kind of growled at me, "I'm not going to vote for anyone who wants to start sticking babies up some old fart's I just, like, I will never forget that. Like, this is not phrasing I could ever come up with in my own head ever. And it's just kind of that image and just everything about it is just kind of stuck in my head.
So how did they go from there?
So after I excused myself from there, I believe that the next person I talked to actually didn't go much more smoothly. So the person who answered, the next person to answer the door was a Jehovah's Witness. Jehovah's Witnesses apparently don't vote. I think it has something to do with elected officials being similar to false gods, something like that. I didn't know this at the time. I did figure this out really, really quickly as soon as the guy opened his door and I kind of opened my mouth and he clearly saw what I was there for. And, you know, what was interesting is that he went sort of into this, like, proselytizing autopilot. It was like he just couldn't shut it off, and I was the one who couldn't get away, which was so weird. I mean, it was so weird to be on the other side trying to, you know, figure out how I could get away from this person. And the script really didn't, like, tell us how to do this. How to run away from, you know, a missionary you may run across. So I think I basically sort of tried to remember what other people had told to me that day when they were trying to get away, and I said something like, Oh, I, you know, I'm sorry, but I have to get back to what I was doing or something.
Which makes absolutely no sense.
Exactly.
In the context.
Yeah, precisely, because I was the one who had sought him out. So, so it was just another one of these absolutely, like, absurd interactions.
Now, what was the weather like? This is Reno in the summer.
Yeah,
right?
This was Reno in late August. It was sweltering. It was so, so hot. And I think it was shortly after the Jehovah's Witness encounter that Matt and I decided, like, we just need a break. Like, it was so hot. We just needed air conditioning. We needed to get out of the sun. You know, I, of course, had come from San Francisco. Like, I was not properly attired in this. I was in my dark wash jeans, and I was, like, sweating like a pig, basically. So what we decided to do, we'd seen a 7-Eleven, like, when we were driving around throughout the neighborhood. So we actually decided to go and hang out in a 7-Eleven. I can't remember the last time I actually hung out in a 7-Eleven, like, this is going to be my thing for the afternoon. I remember it was kind of a big thing to do in 7th or 8th grade. So Matt and I go in, and the air conditioning is just, it's just bliss. Like, we can't even hear each other over the air conditioning. We're just kind of, like, wandering the aisles in a daze, like, picking up, like a Twinkie or, like, a Ding Dong, like, whatever else the 7-Elevens have. And then I get the brilliant idea that we need Slurpees. Like, a Slurpee is just going to be the perfect thing for this. So we, you know, we get the enormous cups, and we slap on the plastic dome lid that lets you fill it up, like, higher than the cup actually goes. And just, like, you know, mix all the flavors and stuff just like you do when you're a kid. And then we go back in the car. We drive around to, you know, we find our next neighborhood, and we're just, like, sitting in the car slurping away.
So did you have any meaningful conversations in this voter drive?
Fortunately, I did. Yeah, and of course, you know, it came sort of at the end of the day, and I mean, it was pretty soon after, like, I'd got the Slurpee. It was sort of reinforced by the Slurpee. I don't know if it was sort of the magic elixir of this Slurpee.
The sugar rush.
Yeah, exactly. The sugar rush, or just being able to sort of, like, you know, just sort of lower my body temperature a little bit where I was actually sane again. But yeah, so this woman answered the door, and it was one of the first people I remember talking to. Like, even the people who were polite, most of them kind of looked like they wanted to get away. But it was one of the first people who didn't look like she wanted to get away immediately. I could see some kids in the background, like, who I assumed belonged to her. But she kind of was ignoring them a little bit, and just, you know, kind of focusing on me. And so we were able to talk, and I was, you know, asking her, "Have you ever voted? Have you ever registered to vote?" And she said no. And I asked her why, which was all kind of part of the standard thing. And she said it was basically because she didn't feel like she knew enough about the issues. And it was then that it really, you know, I really had this kind of epiphanic moment. Like, I really started to figure out why everything had felt kind of so awkward, so stilted up until this point. It really kind of began to occur to me that we were sort of going about this, the driving boats people were going about this the wrong way. I think that we were all under the impression that what we were trying to address was the problem of apathy, of trying to think of enough issues that these folks could care about, that they'd want to vote. But I think that what it was more almost of this sort of, I think they felt really alienated by the process and maybe a little intimidated by the process. And it, you know, began to occur to me that having someone like me, you know, clearly, you know, not from the area, come in from some other place, tell them what to think would probably only make the situation worse. So, you know, it was that point that we just actually started to have that meaningful conversation that I think idealistically I'd wanted to have throughout the day. So we just really started talking about, you know, her life, her, you know, problems that she was having in her life. And her problems were not earth-shattering. I mean, she had to work two jobs. She didn't think her kids' schools were very good. She didn't have enough time to spend with her kids. And as I'm talking to her, and what I tried to kind of communicate to her was that basically all you need to do to make that informed political decision is to think about, you know, what are the changes I would like to see in my own life? And, you know, how does that kind of relate to things that politicians are talking about? So I don't really know, you know, what she felt about nuclear waste or stem cell issues. I mean, we really just kind of kept it focused on her own experience. But we did kind of talk about, you know, how she could kind of figure out what the candidates had to say about these things and maybe what they were planning on doing or saying they would do would impact her life in that way.
Melissa Levitt is an instructor for the program in Writing and Rhetoric at Stanford.